The seven last words of The Unarmed by composer Joel Thompson, performed by The Sphinx, led by conductor Eugene Rogers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we turn to film, we're speaking with Kenneth Chamberlain Jr., his father shot dead by White Plains police in 2011, and Mayo Bartlett, the attorney for the family. On Monday, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled a federal judge was wrong to dismiss parts of a lawsuit against the police for excessive use of force. A new feature film, The Killing of Kenneth Chamberlain, tells the story of what happened the night White Plains police came to Chamberlain's apartment. This is the trailer.
Mr. Chamberlain, this is Candace Wade with Lifeguard Medical Alerts. This line is being reported. You just received an activation from your pendant. Do you have an emergency? I'm not getting a response from you. I'm going to dispatch emergency services now.
White Plains Police!
We're here for a welfare check.
Open this door!
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, new charges have been leveled at the police officers involved in the death of Minneapolis man George Floyd. Protests for racial justice and police reform continue locally through peaceful efforts. And while coronavirus continues to take a toll on Oregonians, 26 counties have applied for Phase 2 of reopening. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 3rd, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. An estimated 10,000 Portlanders gathered yesterday in a protest to end police brutality, marching from Southeast Stark and 12th across the Burnside Bridge and meeting up with thousands more people downtown at Pioneer Square. On this, the sixth night of protesting, which began after the murder of George Floyd, these peaceful protests were met with tear gas and flashbangs around 10 p.m. when some people marched to the fenced Multnomah County Justice Center on Southwest 4th Avenue. Hundreds of protesters, as well as bystanders in that area, were gassed from the front and rear by the police, the Portland Mercury reported. Many protesters then left the area, with an estimated 1,000 protesters returning to the Justice Center. After about a 30-minute standoff, the police claimed that some sort of projectiles were thrown at them, sending them into a fury of tear gassing. The Mercury reports that, quote, far more gas was used than had been used during this series of protests, with, quote, far less provocation. Two reporters from the Mercury were among those gassed last night more than once. 31 counties in Oregon are eligible to move into Phase 2 of the reopening process as soon as Friday of this week. Coronavirus cases, hospitalizations, and deaths are flattening, though they have gone up in the last few days. Oregon currently has 4,399 cases, with 159 recorded deaths. Phase 2 is a significant and likely longer step in the process, since Governor Kate Brown's reopening framework described the third and final phase as, quote, not possible until a reliable treatment or prevention is available. As of now, a reliable treatment or vaccine for coronavirus does not exist. State epidemiologist Dr. Dean Seidlinger outlined the benchmarks that counties are expected to hit in order to further relax restrictions first imposed in March. The first benchmark is time. Counties must be at Phase 1 for at least 14 days. As of late Tuesday, 26 counties have requested to move into Phase 2, and another 7 are considered eligible to do so. In Phase 2, gatherings of up to 50 people may take place indoors, up from 25 people in Phase 1. Outdoor gatherings of up to 100 people are allowed. For larger venues, like movie theaters and churches, they may be able to expand their occupancy to up to 250 people. Working from home is still strongly recommended. Because of their population, Clackamas and Washington counties must operate under Phase 1 for at least 21 days. Multnomah County has not yet applied for Phase 1, but is expected to do so this Friday. The Minnesota Attorney General, Keith Ellison, confirmed today that the three other police officers who were fired over the murder of George Floyd have now been charged. To Tao, J. Alexander Kang, and Thomas Lane will be charged with aiding and abetting second-degree murder. Kang is in custody and warrants have been issued for the other two former police officers. Derek Chauvin's charges have been upgraded from third to second-degree murder, which carries a maximum penalty of 40 years in prison. Chauvin is the officer who kneeled on George Floyd's neck until he died. Ellison, the state attorney general, acknowledged the level of public distrust of prosecutors in police brutality cases because, quote, our country still has under-prosecuted these matters. The investigation is still ongoing, and Ellison refused to speculate on whether the former officers would go to trial or be given plea deals. The officers arrested George Floyd on the evening of May 25th after a store employee called the police saying someone had used a counterfeit $20 bill to buy cigarettes. Ferguson, Missouri, the city that first galvanized the Black Lives Matter movement after police killed Michael Brown in 2014, has elected its first black mayor. Mayor-elect Ella Jones will also be the city's first female mayor, winning the election yesterday with a historic 54% of the vote. Jones has worked as a council member in Ferguson since 2015, then becoming the first black woman to hold that position. In an interview today, Mayor-elect Jones said, quote, my election gives people hope. Everybody is looking for a change. Everybody wants to have a better way of life. You don't want to go four blocks and worry about getting shot. Nobody wants that. It is starting to get better. We are making changes. An FBI report has conclusively found there was no Antifa involvement in the violence that took place in Washington, D.C. on Sunday. KBOO's Nat Moon has more.
Despite Donald Trump's unfounded claims, the FBI has found nothing that would indicate Antifa involvement in the violence surrounding Sunday's protest in Washington, D.C. An FBI situation report with the details was obtained by the news organization The Nation. The report was produced on the same day that Trump announced via Twitter that he would label Antifa a terrorist organization, despite not having the constitutional authority to do so. And while the FBI report did not find any evidence of Antifa involvement, it did warn that members of a far-right social media group, quote, called for far-right provocateurs to attack federal agents and use automatic weapons against protesters. A memo issued by the Department of Homeland Security revealed that a, quote, white supremacist extremist Telegram channel incited followers to engage in violence and start the boogaloo, a term used by violent extremists to refer to the start of a second civil war by shooting into a crowd. In some cases, Salon reports, far-right groups seek to stage Antifa threats of violence on social media. Earlier this week, Twitter shut down a fake Antifa account calling for violence after it was linked to the white nationalist group called Identity Europa, which is classified by the Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate group. Reporting for KBOO, I'm Nat Moon.
While protests over George Floyd's murder and of police reactions to those protests have supplanted the coronavirus atop the headlines, health officials fear the protests will increase the spread of the virus. Gatherings of thousands without social distancing involving intense shouting and stress, plus the effects of tear gas and pepper spray on the lungs, all increase the risk of infection for those involved. Dr. Howard Markle, an expert on pandemics at the University of Michigan, said, quote, this is the worst possible thing that could happen. It's hard to know how many of those people are asymptomatic carriers, and that's really scary, end quote. But the threat of infection is unlikely to deter demonstrators desperate for social change. Dr. Rhea Boyd, expert in minority health policy, said, quote, protests are life-saving for black people in this country. While COVID-19 has killed more than 100,000 Americans in just a few months, studies have found that 1 in 1,000 black men in America are expected to die by police violence in their lifetimes, the same mortality rate as measles. Fulton County District Attorney Paul Howard yesterday announced criminal charges against six officers after the arrest of two Atlanta College students who violated the city's curfew on Saturday. A video shows Atlanta police officers smashing the driver's side window, pulling the students from the car, and tasing them. 20-year-old Spelman College student Tanya Pilgrim and 22-year-old Morehouse College student Messiah Young were near downtown Atlanta when they were surrounded by the group of police officers. hearing that two of the officers who had assaulted him were fired and the other four placed on desk duty, Young said, quote, "I feel safer now that these monsters are off the street and no longer able to terrorize people." Speaking of the two students, District Attorney Howard said, quote, "My investigation concluded they were so innocent, almost to the point of being naive." Because of the pandemic, accessing food has been difficult for reservations across the country. An organization called Running Strong for American Indian Youth has delivered 22 tons of food, my goodness, to families at the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Running Strong for American Indian Youth has delivered 22 tons of food to families on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota as part of COVID-19 relief efforts. Boxes with fruits, vegetables, proteins, and grains have been delivered across the reservation. Field coordinator Dave Lone Elk says accessing food during the pandemic has been of concern with stay-at-home orders and recent lockdowns of the reservation.
Leaving the reservation to go to some of the local grocery stores within an hour's distance are, you know, it's few and far between. We're having a hard time getting there to get the groceries. And so we're left with a few grocery stores that are on the reservation, which tend to be, I think it's around four grocery stores. But when you're dealing with a reservation full of people, that's right around 10,000, you know, grocery stores tend to run out of stock.
Running Strong also distributes clothing, has heating and water programs, along with providing other seasonal assistance.
You know, we reach out and we help each other. If we have extra, we give. That's how we determine wealth. There's how much we give to each other, not how much we accrue. And so we've been doing very good in our efforts in that aspect.
Several COVID-19 orders remain in place on the reservation, including stay-at-home and nightly curfews. As of Tuesday, there were 26 positive COVID-19 cases on the Pine Ridge Reservation, according to the Oglala Sioux Tribe's COVID-19 Response Task Force. The Rosebud Sioux Tribe wants to create the largest Native American-owned and managed bison herd in North America. Seth Tupper with South Dakota Public Broadcasting has more.
Wizipon Little Elk has a big vision for bison on the Rosebud Reservation. He wants to build a herd of 1,500 animals and a processing facility to provide food and economic development for tribal members. He says now is a perfect time for the project. The COVID-19 outbreaks at packing plants and meat shortages in stores have consumers looking for different ways to get their food.
We've always felt that our work was around, you know, self-sufficiency and, you know, empowering families and doing good by people and the world and the environment. And we've always felt that work was important. But I think that what has happened with the coronavirus pandemic is that the world has told us that our work is not only important, but that it is urgent.
Little Elk is CEO of the Rosebud Economic Development Corporation. With help from the World Wildlife Fund, the corporation plans to convert cattle pastures on the reservation to a bison range of 40 square miles. The development corporation will get excess bison from the Interior Department, which manages a number of herds, including those in national parks. Little Elk says the grass-fed bison will be killed and slaughtered humanely.
Basically, what that means is treating buffalo like buffalo and not treating them like cattle.
First, they'll replace cattle fences with bigger, sturdier fences for bison. The first animals are scheduled for delivery this fall, and a feasibility study for a processing plant will begin soon. For National Native News, I'm Seth Tupper in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Some Native candidates running for Congress won Tuesday's primary election, unofficial results show. The Shoshone-Bannock tribes congratulated tribal members Rudy Soto and Paulette Jordan on social media Tuesday night after Idaho's election, Jordan seeking to serve in the U.S. Senate and Soto in the House. Both are Democrats. In New Mexico, Congresswoman Deb Haaland, Laguna Pueblo, did not have a Democratic challenger in the primary. She'll seek another term. Yvette Harrell, Cherokee Nation, won the Republican nomination for a U.S. House seat. Two other Native candidates in New Mexico who ran for Congress lost, Republicans Elisa Martinez and Gavin Clarkson. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the recruiting process for the Citizen Review Committee. Then stay tuned at 5:45 for news from the BOO, your look at the news inside KBOO. And stick around at 7 o'clock, we'll be hearing Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 51. Tomorrow's weather, partly cloudy as well with a high of 73 degrees. Today in history, in 1989, the Chinese military opened fire on pro-democracy supporters in Beijing, marking the beginning of what became known as the Tiananmen Square Massacre. 10,000 people died in the month-and-a-half-long protests. The quote of the day is from novelist Ma Jian, who was among the million freedom protesters who gathered there. She wrote, quote, "My most vivid memory of the Tiananmen days is the time I stood high on the monument to the people's heroes one afternoon in late May and looked down on a crowd of more than a million people assembled in the square. Every face beamed with hope and joy. The colorful swath of humanity looked as peaceful as a meadow of wildflowers. There was a euphoric sense that after decades of tyranny, the Chinese people had found the courage to take full control of their lives and attempt to change the fate of their nation." Eight states plus Washington, D.C. had primaries yesterday in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic and police brutality across the country. With more on the story, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
A brother of mine asked me the other day, he said, "Has this world gone crazy?" And my reply to him was, "No, it's always been crazy. We're just tired of it."
O.J. Simmons of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe in South Dakota is executive director for Corrections, a Native American voting rights group.
Native Americans have been dealing with these issues for hundreds and hundreds of years. And so we support everybody that is doing these protests that are bringing these issues, because racism happens when you're not sitting at that table.
Four Directions has been campaigning for Native candidates in yesterday's local primaries in Rapid City, South Dakota, which has a large indigenous population. Eight states plus Washington, D.C. had primaries yesterday: South Dakota, Pennsylvania, Montana, Indiana, Iowa, Rhode Island, Maryland, and New Mexico. In some jurisdictions, things ran smoothly. In others, there were long lines due to far fewer polling sites and poll workers. With the massive demand for absentee ballots, some voters received theirs late or not at all. New Mexico is home to part of the Navajo Nation. After a huge spike in new coronavirus cases in April, the nation has been enforcing curfews and checkpoints to reduce its spread. Heather Ferguson from Common Cause New Mexico says the restrictions exacerbate existing challenges to access to voting.
If folks can explain to their checkpoint officer that they are going to a specific polling location, they have been exempted from some of the different quarantine curfews that they've set out for our nations, and that way they can go to an outside source to be able to vote. We still do not have any active voting locations on many of our tribes and pueblos around the state.
From Common Cause Pennsylvania, Suzanne Almeida shares a different kind of challenge. Voters might be wary of polling places located in municipal buildings, sometimes shared with police precincts.
The violence that we have seen from police officers against Black and Brown people, you know, starting in Minneapolis and spreading across the country, including in Pennsylvania, this presents a real challenge to voters of color who now have to walk past that police presence to cast their ballot.
Former Vice President Joe Biden spoke from Philadelphia City Hall yesterday, his first appearance outside Delaware since the pandemic began. He called on Congress to immediately ban chokeholds, stop the transfer of war weapons to municipal police, improve oversight and accountability, and establish a use of force standard, recommendations from more than 400 good government and civil rights groups.
No more excuses, no delays. If Mitch McConnell can bring in the United States Senate to confirm Trump's unqualified judicial nominees who will run roughshod over our Constitution now, it's time to pass legislation that will give true meaning to our constitutional promise of equal protection under the law.
With just a few presidential primaries left, President Trump announced he's pulling this summer's Republican National Convention from Charlotte. Other options discussed are Orlando, Jacksonville, or Las Vegas. This after North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper insisted their convention would indeed need to be planned with coronavirus restrictions in mind. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael isn't holding his breath.
Breathe free, breathe deep this fresh spring air. Trump's been spraying his accelerant for years, and the matches can't come soon enough for him. All his threats and bluster are taking my breath away, as if that 300-pound dodo was kneeling on my neck, on my heart. Using pepper spray, rubber bullets, and military helicopters against a peaceful protest just so he could walk through and have a photo op is a whole nother movie, another world. People have asked Trump to show leadership, and so he does, leading us to a place we don't want to go. I can breathe. I will breathe. Try and stop me. I want to inspire, resuscitate, strengthen. I want fresher, cleaner air, a possible healing future. The greatest single threat of pollution, the greatest threat to our national health, must be removed. I hope November's not too late. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Iowa Representative Steve King, who has repeatedly made headlines for his racist views, lost to a fellow Republican yesterday in Iowa's primary. Here's KBOO's Nat Moon with more on the story.
Steve King of Iowa, a 9-term racist Republican congressperson, lost his bid for renomination on Wednesday in one of the biggest defeats of the 2020 primary season. He was defeated by Randy Feenstra, a state senator who had the backing of mainstream state and national Republicans, who found King an embarrassment. King is infamous for meeting with anti-Muslim crusaders in Europe and endorsing a Toronto mayoral candidate with neo-Nazi ties. He was stripped of his committee assignments last year in Congress after, in an interview with the New York Times, he asked, quote, white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive? In a Facebook video after his loss, King encouraged Iowans to continue to, quote, teach our children well about values we care about, including opposition to abortion and same-sex marriage. Although perhaps less controversial, Feenstra has promised he will fight with President Trump to build the wall and boasted that he had voted in the Iowa Senate to ban sanctuary cities and defund Planned Parenthood. Reporting for KBOO, I'm Nat Moon.
Activists say those least responsible for causing climate change are often those most severely affected by it. Andrea Sears has more on that story.
An interfaith group working to slow climate change says there is a link between ending reliance on fossil fuels and the protests taking place across the country. The COVID-19 pandemic and protests over the police killing of George Floyd, an unarmed African-American man in Minneapolis, have eclipsed many other major news stories. But according to Reverend Allison Cornish with Pennsylvania Interfaith Power and Light, the long history of systemic racism sparking nationwide protests is part of the climate crisis, too.
We know that people with fewer resources and less power and who are more oppressed are going to be people deeply affected by climate.
She says the challenge is to confront racism and climate change not as separate problems, but as related crises that must be dealt with as a whole to save the planet and each other. Cornish says Interfaith Power and Light is composed of people from a wide spectrum of religious beliefs, including evangelicals, Catholics, Protestants, Jews, and Muslims.
We come together because we feel stronger in numbers and in voice if we set aside some of the ways in which we differ and find ways in which we agree, because we all know that our earth is in peril.
She adds that the faith community sees climate change as a moral and ethical issue based in their commitment to good stewardship of the earth and its people. Cornish notes that Interfaith Power and Light began by looking at ways congregations could use energy efficiency and renewable energy to cut their carbon footprints, but the mission has expanded to include advocacy that goes beyond the faith community.
We help people track the issues at the state and federal level that will help transition us in a just way to a new energy future.
She says faith communities perform functions that are desperately needed now, helping people to grieve what is being lost, to join in common efforts, and to find hope for the future. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
A civil rights investigation has been launched into the Minneapolis Police Department, but experts say changing police culture is very difficult. We go now to Mike Moen to learn more.
Minnesota officials have launched a civil rights investigation into the entire Minneapolis Police Department following the killing of George Floyd. It coincides with calls for reform, but watchdogs elsewhere say changing police culture is very difficult. Other recent high-profile incidents have prompted reforms within MPD, but skeptics say what happened to Floyd shows not much has changed. Harriet Walden, with the group Mothers for Police Accountability in Seattle, was involved in reform efforts when that city's police department came under federal scrutiny. She says there was a lot of optimism at first, but the problems persist.
The Seattle police enforcement still had disparities along racial lines. That was 2019. People of color were more likely to be frisked than white people and more likely to have weapons put in their face, even though those people didn't have weapons on them.
Walden is referring to the Seattle department's own disparity review from last year. And she says broader discussions about the nation's history of discrimination need to find a platform within police agencies. Meanwhile, Minnesota's Human Rights Commissioner vows the investigation will lead to meaningful action, not just a report. Walden thinks negotiations with police unions have played a role in slowing reform efforts across the country, and that leaders at City Hall need to be held accountable as well.
The city's job is to get the best thing for the city and to hold the line. And in my opinion, sometimes the cities don't always do that.
In Minneapolis, the city's powerful police union leader, Bob Kroll, has been criticized for fostering cultural issues within the rank and file. In response to the George Floyd aftermath, Kroll issued a letter to union members blasting city and police leadership over the protests and blaming the violence on a, quote, terrorist movement. Sam Sanchez is an organizer with a Twin Cities activist group calling for an even more dramatic overhaul of the department by amending the city charter to have a community panel run the force.
These would be elected officials from the community that would be in charge of all aspects of the police department, up to picking the chief, to the budget, to the rule book.
Sanchez says this would remove conflicts of interest by no longer having officers hold their own colleagues accountable. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 3rd, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Nat Moon, Sam Bowman, Dan Raphael, and Althea Billings. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Andrea Sears, and Mike Moen. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, with your host, Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, we'll hear Fight the Empire, connecting history to current events. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's your book talk show, Between the Covers, and at 11:30, Black Book Talk, featuring interviews from the Black Book Talk vault. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm, or you can use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. Portland's longest-standing Citizen Police Oversight Board is the Citizen Review Committee, which is part of the Auditor's Office Independent Police Review Division, or IPR. The CRC is an 11-member, all-volunteer body that hears appeals of police misconduct cases. The CRC has a strict standard of review that requires its members to consider only the evidence that internal police investigators had available to them. The CRC cannot gather or consider new evidence. Right now, the CRC is recruiting new applicants to fill 5 positions, reaching the end of their terms this year. The CRC has seen both unprecedented success and slightly more typical upheaval over the past year, culminating in the resignation of several members, including Committee Chair Kristen Malone. For more on the recruitment process and the current state of the Citizen Review Committee, KABU reporter Sam Bowman spoke to Irene Konev, IPR's Senior Community Outreach Coordinator. We should say that a number of the CRC's cases, including many of those covered by KABU in the past few years, have focused on police responses to protest events. However, this interview was conducted in the days before this past weekend's major demonstrations and does not address the numerous documented instances of questionable police behavior during those events.
So there's currently a recruitment effort underway for the CRC, the Citizen Review Committee.
Yes.
How many positions are being filled right now?
So we have 5 people terming out, which means that the 5 people who are on the Citizen Review Committee need to reapply for their positions again. And the 5 people that are on will compete for the positions with the other people, the new people that are applying.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So currently, how many positions are filled on the CRC?
There are a total of 11 positions, and there are 3-year terms, and they go through a rigorous selection process. We find community leaders who understand how our process works, and we try to bring in a broad representation of people to select the applicants, and then the applicants go through an interview process, and this is all per city code that was established when IPR was set up.
Okay, and is there a alternate pool that you draw from for CRC positions?
Yeah, so we try to, because you know this is a volunteer position and this is, it can be a lot of work sometimes because an appeal can involve many pages of police reports to police records to go through. And so sometimes people, you know, make a commitment of 3 years, but you know, things happen. We've had several members who got promoted, 2 of our members ran for office recently, and so like people move to different positions and so they resign, and so having a pool of alternates ready to go and trained is our process.
Okay, and you mentioned a little bit about some of the outreach that's being done, but just more specifically, what sort of outreach do you do for a recruitment push like this?
Yeah, well, our application is usually up on the website before we begin the active process of recruiting. So I reach out to neighborhood associations and business leaders, colleges, church groups. I have a huge network of people I reach out to, Portland State University, Oregon Health and Science University, Warner Pacific College. I have contacts all over the city. I've been in this job for 11 years now, and I've met a lot of friends who became allies of our work. And so they send it out on their social media. And sometimes we put it on Oregon Live, depending on how many positions we're looking for. And so it's basically networks of networks of networks is how our application goes out, and you know, spending time on the radio and talking about it as well.
All right. So what sort of training would recruits go through before being a fully active member of the CRC?
So we take them through an actual case of how they would review a case that would come before them in the appeal process. So that's about a 3-hour training where we walk them through this is how the appeal file looks like. Here's a checklist of things to think about. Making sure that they're using a non-biased approach, evidence-based approach to their file review. And we also do a session on trauma-informed approach to this work. We have equity training, equity, diversity, and inclusion training. That is usually within the first, so the first one would be like an overview of who IPR is, Independent Police Review, like who we are, how we were formed, a little bit of the history. There's often a session from the auditor. She comes in and basically does an overview of her office. This training is done in conjunction with folks from the internal affairs who talk about how to review a police review board case. So it's pretty intense, and it's very, we try to prepare our volunteers as much as possible. And then they spend one day, like as part of this education process at the training division. Before COVID, it was an in-person training. I don't know how we're going to move forward now, but they basically partner up with a police officer. They deploy a taser. They can use a shooting range. They do automobile maneuvers. They do scenario-based negotiations and things like that. So they basically walk with an officer for a day. And then they're also required to go on a ride-along before they review cases.
I'm not sure how to phrase this exactly, but is there a component of the training that that involves members of the community to give new CRC members an idea of sort of the perspective of some sectors of the community on this sort of work?
Are you talking about that they have a better understanding of policing through the eyes of different people who may experience police differently?
Yeah, I think to get an idea of the experience of sort of being policed rather than doing police work.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up, because that is the first hour of the equity training. We basically talk about the origins of policing, and we talk about how did policing become part of the process in America, and basically from way back in the 1800s, and how law enforcement was used in basically the oppression of people, and that we go through that whole process from that equity lens of what it might feel like to be policed. So that I'm glad you asked that question.
Great, thank you. I know that recently in the, I think I'm telescoping this whole COVID pandemic thing a little bit, so I'm really referring to the first months of the year and the end of last year. But there were some resignations from the CRC, I think Neil Simon, Daniel Schwartz, and Kristen Malone. Mm-hmm. Are any of those positions among the ones being filled, or have they been filled already?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. Yeah, those positions were filled recently, and the way that we structure the recruitment is so that everybody isn't terming off at the same time. So the positions that you just mentioned, those were filled, and now we're running another recruitment because other positions are terming out. So we're just trying to make sure that there's a rotation of people. So when I first started, they all were terming out at the same time. And what we found was that it was really hard to get 9-10 positions at once, and that there wasn't that transfer of knowledge where all the people are new sometimes. Mm-hmm. But most people would reapply, but a lot of times we'd have so many new members that a lot of that institutional knowledge was lost. So we try to make sure that as new members are coming on, there are existing members who have some institutional memory.
And so it sounds like this, five positions being open is sort of part of the process. It's not more or less than normal.
Yeah, no, it's part of the process because we had another large recruitment 3 years ago, and new members came on and they stayed there three terms, and now those terms are up, and so the same people have to reapply for their positions, and it's going to depend on that applicant pool in this recruitment if the current members get selected or not. And like I said, again, that's per city code. But we make sure that there are usually six or seven people on the selection committee. So there's a broad perspective of who gets selected.
Okay. Are you able to talk about who's on that committee at all?
I know that your time is limited. I would love to add that what we're looking for, because a lot of people when I'm doing recruitment are like, what are you looking for? And so if you don't mind, I'd love to share
go ahead.
what we're looking for. So we're looking for someone who can demonstrate ability to be like impartial and objective. And I know that we all come to our own biases about different things, but we're looking at someone who's going to be able to, because the appeals can be brought before the Citizen Review Committee from police officers too. Police officers have the right to bring an appeal to the CRC. Community members have the right to bring an appeal to the CRC. So what we're looking for is someone who's going to be able to see the side of policing, like what it's like to be a police officer, and also the community member. So they have to have that impartial, objective perspective. And obviously they have to have really good communication and listening skills, because these cases are reviewed, are voted on in public. The files are confidential that they read, but they deliberate in public. And so, you know, getting along with each other and really listening, and also listening to complainants or appellants when they're in front of them. So those are really important skills that we're looking for. And they have to be City of Portland residents, or they have to have a business that's registered at the City of Portland. And, you know, you alluded to this earlier, they have to be able to understand what it's like to be policed and like some of the historical context, because some of our cases that they hear might have bias. Bias based type of pieces of the case that they have to look at. So,
okay.
And it's a pretty big time commitment too. So we ask a lot of our volunteers, but we prepare and train them really well.
Yeah, that was actually my last question was what is the hourly commitment roughly?
So if there's an appeal, so the standard meeting is once a month from 5:30 to about 7:30 or 8. If it's an appeal, so there's depending, like some appeal cases can have 150 pages of data to review. There might also be videos, so there's going to be time involved in reviewing the case. So we broadly, and then sometimes we have two appeals a month. That doesn't happen very often, but it can be as intense as 10 hours a week. But for the most part, it's that one monthly meeting that they have to attend the first Wednesday of the month. And if they work in work groups to bring forward policy reviews, then there's also like an hour or two. And volunteers can be really busy and work in several work groups, or they can work on appeals and just attend the meetings. It's really up to them.
Great. And so if people are interested, they can find the application on IPR's website?
Yes. The website is, I don't know if you...
PortlandOregon.gov/IPR.
Yep.
Okay.
And it's right on the then you, if you look on the Citizen Review Committee, it's right there on the left. Yeah, okay. And I can also share my phone number if someone wants to reach out to me and talk about this. The phone number is 503-823-2735. And I'm going to repeat it. It's 503-823-2735.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you too.
And is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up?
I just wanted to say that this is really, really important work. Often we get to make some policy recommendations at the CRC level that can impact an entire bureau, and that is where the highest impact the volunteers have. So I would just encourage people who want to see change, apply.
Great. Well, Irene Konev, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, too.
That was KBOO reporter Sam Bowman speaking with Irene Konev, the Senior Community Outreach Coordinator at the City Auditor's Independent Police Review Division.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Well, good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo here on KBOO Community Radio.
Your community connection.
Oh, yeah, your community connection. Listener-supported, volunteer-powered here on KBOO Portland. I am Jenny Okuyama, and I am joined with my fellow interim station co-manager Celeste Carey.
How's everybody?
I know I'm doing okay. I'm gonna admit, I'm not doing the best this week, but you know,
Been a rough week.
I think it's been a rough week for many people.
Yes,
you know?
It has. But how about some good news? Let's start with some good news.
All right, let's start with some good cable news.
Okay, I'm gonna do the drum roll. We don't know the totals yet, but we suspect we have reached our spring appeal goal.
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, 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 dun. That's exciting stuff.
Is very exciting. We couldn't have done it if you all had not shown us your love.